Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
The story of the Ghost Army is one of creativity flourishing under the most extreme circumstances. Their best art was not the paintings and drawings they left behind, but the ephemeral masterpieces they created on the battlefield.
Can you picture the German commander after he was preparing to defend himself and perhaps attack over in our direction, going over there and finding nothing? Maybe a lot of tank tracks, because we were gone. That's the Ghost Army.
The Ghost Army of World War II, the 23rd Headquarters Special Troops, used art and illusion as weapons in the fight against the Germans on the battlefields of Europe. Sounds of troops deploying, blasted through loudspeakers, inflatable tanks, fake radio broadcasts, and other forms of deception to get the Nazis to move to the wrong location as our real troops advanced. I'm Glenn Moberg. It's a special Veterans Week edition of Route 51 as we welcome to our Wisconsin Public Radio studios Gazo Nemeth, who served in the Signal Special Company, the radio deception arm of the Ghost Army. Joining us by phone, John Jarvie, who served in the 603rd Camouflage Engineers, the visual deception arm of the Ghost Army. And finally, Rick Beyer, writer, producer, and director of the PBS documentary, The Ghost Army, and co-author with Elizabeth Sales of the book, Ghost Army of World War II. The Ghost Army has been the focus of two community presentations this week in central Wisconsin, Tuesday evening at Edgar High School, last night at the UW Marathon County Center for Civic Engagement, thanks to the Walk in Their Shoes School History Program and its director, Colin Hansen. As always, we welcome your phone calls if you'd like to talk to some real legendary American heroes this Veterans Week. Please give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I will read it live on the air. John Jarvie and Gazo Nemeth, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, I'm honored and flattered and thrilled to be here.
And, John, you're still with us on the East Coast.
Still hanging on here, ready to go.
All right. And, Rick Beyer, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I watched the documentary, and I read the book. What made this story so interesting to you?
Well, Glenn, first of all, let me say it's a pleasure to be here and a pleasure to be able to present to all these folks in central Wisconsin. I was kind of blown away by the unexpected nature of the story, the idea that people are using inflatable tanks, they're using sound effects and radio deception on the battlefields of Europe. I had heard about the D-Day deception, where they were trying to fool the Germans about where the D-Day landings would be, but I had never heard this story, and it really kind of blew my mind and got me – I started working on it 10 years ago, and it's still holding on to me.
Well, the foreword to the book says, military deception is much like a successful magic trick. It's about fooling people into believing that something is happening that isn't.
Exactly right. So you're pretending to be you're pretending to show force in a place where there is no force. So you're trying to manipulate the mind of the enemy. You're trying to get into their head and make them do what you want them to do without loss of life or huge resources that you may not have.
Well, hopefully without loss of life, but the Ghost Army put themselves on the line. They were in danger every time they took out a mission.
Well, they certainly many of their missions took them close to the front. They certainly took casualties, and they did have three people killed, several dozen wounded. And, you know, I think a lot of the soldiers say, oh, we weren't really in danger that much. But they were taking risks many times when they were carrying out these deceptions.
You and Gazo Nemeth have been making appearances around central Wisconsin this week. Rick, how's that been going?
Well, the response has just been amazing. And we talked yesterday to 1,500 students in Edgar brought from various schools around the area. We spoke to 300 people last night at UW. So amazing response. And I think, you know, people respond to this story the same way I respond to it. They start to find out about it. They get interested. They find out more, and they see how fascinating it is.
And again, we can't thank Colin Hansen and A Walk in Their Shoes enough. This is the same program that brought Chester Nez, one of the last Navajo code talkers into central Wisconsin, and also the Tuskegee Airmen.
Well, Colin is a treasure to your area. He would hate hearing me say that. If he's listening now, he's hating hearing that. But listen, you guys, don't—
I embarrass him every time
I go
on the air.
Don't take him for granted. People probably think, oh, this is what it's like everywhere. It's not. This is a very special thing that he's doing for the area, and he deserves a tremendous amount of credit for that.
Gazo, how have the young people you've met received you and the story of the Ghost Army? What's been your impression?
I think they were wonderful. I think we can trust the next generation to carry on probably better than we did. There were some great young people we met everywhere in both schools, and they treated me wonderful. They were very interested. And I never shook hands with so many people in my life.
It's like you were running for president.
Yeah. And so I would say I was impressed very much by the students.
Well, it would be very hard for this current generation or any generation to do for America and the world what your generation did.
Right.
Not just in World War II, but in the Great Depression before that, and then building the world that we have now in the 50s, and many of the people that you served with went on to lead very, very productive lives.
Oh, yes. I met a wealthy woman a little while ago, and she says she after seeing the Ghost Army, she would never buy any clothes that wasn't designed by Bill Blass.
And Bill Blass, the famous fashion designer, was one of the artists in the Ghost
Army.
Artists. John Jarvie, did you have a chance to meet Bill Blass as one of the camouflage engineers?
Yes, I did. I used to bump into him occasionally after the war.
And a lot of the artists that you served with, not just Bill Blass, went on to lead very productive lives, including you, John Jarvie. You were an artist who worked with Women's Wear Daily. You supervised a team of artists.
I had a group of 10 artists working with me and several writers all in the one group. And we went on, carried on for several years. And I must say, we did pretty well, considering.
Now, as one of
after
the...
After that...
Go on.
Yes, after that, I went on to Buick, and I became an official in one of the agencies uptown that handled Buick, and then stayed there until 1992, when I decided to hang up my pen and pencil.
John, can I ask you how old you are?
I'm 93.
And Gazo, how old are you?
I was 20 years old when I went into the service.
And what about now? My math isn't that good.
I'm now 93 and a half and holding.
you know, Rick, this is a common theme with these shows that I've been doing over the past few years. We've got the greatest generation, the people who got us through the Great Depression. They won World War II. They built America and the world as we know it. And there are fewer and fewer of them all the time.
Well, you know, there were 1,100 men serving in the Ghost Army. And my best guess is that there's less than 40 of them still alive today. So it's why it's so special when you can make presentations or be on a radio show like this and actually hear these guys. And, you know, they are also, I think, they did all the things that you said, Glenn, and they're just very, very humble as well. And that's kind of awesome in its own way.
Well, let me read a paragraph from the book you wrote. Their mission was to put on a show with the German army as the audience. They were plugging a hole in General George Patton's line by pretending to be the 6th Armored Division with all its tanks and might. But in fact, this cast of artists, designers, radio operators, and engineers was equipped instead with battalions of rubber dummies, a world-class collection of sound effects records, and all the creativity the soldiers could muster. They understood all too well that their own lives depended on the quality of their performance. If the Germans saw through their deceptions, they could attack and overrun the small, lightly armed unit, but thousands of other lives were at stake as well. If the Germans realized how thinly held the sector was, they could break through and attack Patton from the rear.
Well, and that's the story of the Ghost Army. They are You know, they are 1,100 guys pretending to be essentially maybe 15,000, maybe 20,000, you know, much, much larger units and, you know, doing all the showbiz fakery that they can put out there to make that happen.
Gazo Nemeth, what was it like being there? Let's go back to September of 1944. You're just 2 miles from the front line, just a handful of men putting on a show to deceive the Germans.
Well, we were so successful with our equipment up until then, we weren't worried about it at all. We had, it was just another mission to be sent on, and we didn't realize that we were going to be so damn close to the Germans. It could probably be overrun in any minute.
What were the kinds of things you had to do as a radio operator to make that deception work?
Well, what we would do, we would be chosen by Chafe headquarters, their liaison officer, and who would go where, because we never really took the place of three divisions, which we could do, but was usually just one. And we would move in with our radio equipment and set up alongside the real combat division radio operators, and every radio team had three men. So I would listen for 2 hours, then go off for four. Second man would listen for 2 hours, and then the third man. And by that time, we have a good idea how fast they were transmitting, how often, and to where. And after a given moment, they went off the air and we went on.
Now, what I read is that you made it impossible to tell your radio broadcasts from the real thing. You could even impersonate the keystrokes used by individual Morse code operators in other units, which the Germans had learned how to recognize.
That's true. That was the main idea. We don't jump in there and transmit twice as fast as the last guy and try to the same tempo and about the same speed and about the same often. Don't try to ram in too much when they weren't doing that much.
John Jarvie, what was your role? And let's go back to that deployment where you guys really helped out General Patton's army on the Moselle River between the border of Germany and Luxembourg.
What was our role?
Yeah, John Jarvie?
Yes, I remember well. We were up in, kind of northeastern Belgium. And we really didn't know what the whole story was. When you get down to the enlisted men and so on, you go where you're told.
Well, what were the kinds of things you had to do in the field in order to make that deception work as a camouflage engineer?
Make sure that the Germans saw us and knew what we were up to. But what we were up to wasn't what we were really supposed to do. We had fake tanks, rubber tanks, sound effects, and that's what we were up to, really, but they didn't know it.
John,
did that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Everything you say makes sense. John, what was it like firing up one of those air compressors on the front line at night?
That woke everybody. Everybody right out in the front lines. We did that all across Europe. First time was out at Brest when they were trying to clear out Brest. And we had those sound effects going all over. And the American infantry was out there, and they didn't know what the hell was happening. You know, it was noise from us where they wanted to keep quiet. They didn't want the Germans to know they were there. But we wanted the Germans to know that we were there in force. We had tanks and a lot
fake,
of equipment.
Phony tanks, right? Inflatable.
Let the Germans know it.
Phony inflatable tanks. And I think that's what Rick was talking about with the air compressor. You had to go out there to keep the tank inflated in the middle of the night? Did you ever feel vulnerable? I mean, going out there in the middle of the night and then firing up a loud air compressor by yourself to try to blow up an inflatable tank?
Yes, the answer is yes. But we got used to it, and I think we got some kind of a thrill out of it. As you know, the infantry was hunkered down, and they didn't want anybody disturbing the atmosphere or making movement on the roads or all those things that would attract attention. But at the same time, that's what we were doing. That was our job, to attract attention and let the Germans know we had a lot of power there.
Now, if you didn't inflate that tank, I read that the gun barrel would sag.
Absolutely. And there's no more depressing picture than a rubber tank with the gun barrel sagging, especially when you think it's supposed to be a real tank.
You know, and
it's kind of comical.
And funny as that is, you know, it's a example with deception that, you know, one tiny detail wrong is like the thread that unravels the whole sweater. So, you know, you have to pay very careful attention to monitoring the tanks. You know, one of the things we've talked about, an M4 Sherman tank weighs 40 tons. When you drive it over a farm field, it leaves a deep track, okay? An inflatable tank weighs 90 pounds. There's no tank track. So you have to have the mind of an artist like John and the other people in the unit. So they used a bulldozer at night when they're setting up the tanks to put phony tank tracks in. So that's the kind of attention to detail that they had to do, all these guys had to do to make these deceptions work.
John, you studied art before the war. Did it ever occur to you how valuable your training as an artist would be on the battlefield?
Never thought of it. Never thought of it. And I was very pleasantly surprised when I found out there was a unit that wanted to hire artists. And they stated the reason. Not rubber tanks, but camouflage and things like that. And I was in Cooper Union then.
How did the other soldiers, the ones who were actually fighting on the battlefield, look at you guys, this group of artists?
Did you hear me laugh?
Yeah.
That's how they looked at it, you know. It was questionable and kind of comical. And when they gave it some thought, then they laughed. When you thought about what we were doing, it was kind of funny. It was dangerous, but on the other side of the coin, it was funny.
And you and your colleagues, the other artists, you kept diaries of the war with your own pencil and ink illustrations?
Oh, yes. We couldn't have lived without that. That we all amassed a lot of work. I'm sitting and looking at a lot of it right now. I keep it around me, and I love it.
Rick Beyer, you put a lot of those drawings in your book on the Ghost Army. I think a lot of those guys probably didn't think, when they were doing this in their spare time, that they were actually leaving behind important historical documents.
Well, and that's the way it is with historical documents, that, you know, the people who are writing a letter or doing something, whether it's 70 years ago or 700 years ago, it's just the natural thing that they're doing, and they don't realize that somebody might be looking at this, you know, years later and interpreting their period through it. And the art of the Ghost Army soldiers, you know, a lot of them, they threw it in a backpack, they threw it in the back of a truck, it ended up in a box in the attic, it ended up on a wall in the basement, and digging it out, a lot of the soldiers have actually rediscovered their own artworks and kind of rediscovered the view of the war that they captured, and that's just been a tremendous, tremendous part of the story.
Let's play a clip from the documentary. This was back in the 1940s, before computers and audio files. The sound effects that you used were cut on records and played back on turntables.
In early 1944, Raley sent a team with a portable audio studio down to the Army Proving Ground at Fort Knox, Kentucky. Working with experts from Bell Labs, they spent 3 weeks recording sounds onto 16-inch transcription discs, the same kind used to make hit records.
the recordings were brilliant. I mean, if there was a road leading up, the music had to be described. The change of gears, the tanks going up, the tanks going down, the tanks assembling.
And then we'd go to another spot where the trucks were just flying through on the highway.
They had the recordings of building a pontoon bridge or any type of bridge, and you could hear them hammering away and swearing. And
different sounds could then be queued up on different turntables and mixed together to create whatever scenario was required.
And this was before reel-to-reel tape recorders, but Rick Beyer, there was a new technology at the time that allowed the effects to be recorded on magnetic wire. It wasn't tape, but it was wire, which wouldn't skip like a record.
Right. It's the weirdest thing now to look at, but this was state-of-the-art technology in 1944. And if you were looking at it, you'd see a reel of wire. It's about the thickness of fishing line. And 6 feet of this wire makes 1 second of sound. And so you need about 2 miles of wire for 30 minutes. So they could mix their shows onto this wire. Then they had the wire recorders that they put in the half tracks, and they play them back. And people who were there told me that it was so effective that sometimes they would hear the sounds. They began to see tanks that weren't actually there, even though they knew there weren't any tanks there, but the sounds were so good they started to believe it themselves. So
the members of the Ghost Army, yeah. And I imagine psychologically, if you're on that battlefield, John Jarvie, after you listen to this for hours on end, it probably would have a little bit of an effect on you.
Absolutely, and it was a helpful effect. As a matter of fact, even though you knew it was fake, you began to believe it was real.
And I read in your book, Rick, that they had to use creative techniques, for instance, to remove the Doppler effect, which is the sound you'd get in a change in a pitch that would occur when a truck passed by a microphone so that wouldn't be heard on the battlefield.
Right, so you hear a race car goes by and it goes, and the pitch changes. So you can't have that happen in a recording. It would give it away. So they'd put a microphone when they were recording the sounds in the middle and drive trucks or tanks in a circle around it so that you don't have that kind of effect. So there's creativity in this story, but there's also a great technology story and kind of a smart state-of-the-art technology thinking.
And Gazo, I'm sure that you're on the front lines. You're listening to all of this stuff. Were you able to observe the people who were actually putting that through the loudspeakers on the trucks that were there?
Yeah, we could see a lot of it, but not everything. Everywhere, the three divisions really weren't that close together all the time.
And the three divisions were you as a radio operator, John Jarvie, who was doing the camouflage, and then the other guys who were doing these loudspeaker.
Right. But, and you talk about the artist. I personally never saw one of them doing it. I'm amazed when I read about it because we were not allowed to have cameras. Every word we sent out was highly censored, and I couldn't believe this was going on even.
Now, Rick, they pulled off 21 deceptions, are credited with saving thousands of lives, serving dangerously close to the front lines.
Yeah, and then it's secret for 40 years, and nobody knows anything about it. And some of the soldiers talked about it, but some of them didn't tell their wives, I think. Gazo didn't tell his wife or children what he did in the war.
Is that true, Gazo? You went 40 years without telling your wife or your kids what you were involved with?
I never was able to tell them anything.
Why not?
Because it was highly censored, and the Pentagon believed sooner or later we might have a war with the Russians, and we don't want to let them know what we'd done to fool the Germans because we'd use it on the Russians too. But then last year, some fool decided we could trust the Russians, so they released the documentary about it.
You know, I think that it was declassified a little longer ago, but I believe, Gazo, correct me, I believe this is true, that you did not know that this was declassified until you saw the PBS documentary.
That's true. I was stunned when I seen it on PBS. And from Naples, we lived in Fort Myers for 26 years. And I called them up, and they were stunned that there was somebody that close that had actually been in the Ghost Army, and they let me have a disc, and I've been asked to go and show it 23 times, different places, and sell out crowds everywhere we went. It was often used as a fundraiser by the Holocaust Museum 3 times, and our own gated community in Jamaica Bay, Fort Myers, had sellout crowds every time they showed it, and everybody enjoyed it, was thrilled, and learned stuff that they had never dreamt of, including several people told me they were studying the history and writing a history of World War II, and they never knew anything about the Ghost Army until we showed it.
John Jarvie, did you tell your wife when you got, before it was declassified?
Not really. We had a lot to talk about besides that. I mean, relative to the Army. But we never got into the itty-bitties of what we were really doing.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, more memories from John Jarvie and Gazo Nemeth, surviving members of the Ghost Army of World War II, and Rick Beyer, who co-wrote a book about it and produced and wrote the PBS documentary. I'm Glenn Mobrick. This is a special Veterans Week edition of Route 51.
Barges approach shore ready for instant action, some bearing artillery and rocket guns already opening fire. Today, the armies of the United Nations have made their first landings on the soil of Western Europe. Another of the great decisive battles of world history has been joined. This is the day for which free people long have waited. This is D-Day.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Chippewa Valley Theater Guild, UW-River Falls Wyman Series, and the Minnesota Beethoven Festival. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. More information at wpr.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Christine Bremer-Moogley of the personal injury law firm Bremer & Trollope, committed to protecting the rights of accident victims throughout Wisconsin. Bremer & Trollope, because the right results matter most. Bremer-Law.com.
Their mission was to inflate the apparent size of the American forces attacking Brest by impersonating the 6th Armored Division. They sought to draw German reserves to the flanks, clearing the way for an attack in the center. Sound trucks pulled to within a few hundred yards of German lines.
Crank the speakers up out of the back of the half track and play a program to the enemy all night of us bringing equipment into the scene. We could make them believe that we were coming in with an armored division.
They painted 6th armored markings on their trucks and drove them back and forth through nearby towns.
We did a lot of ride-through with 2 guys in the back of a truck to make it look like it was full.
Captured German officers revealed to interrogators that they were convinced the 6th Armored was really there.
Now you're listening to a clip from the PBS documentary, The Ghost Army. With us today on this special Veterans Week edition of Route 51, Rick Beyer, who wrote and produced the documentary, and 2 surviving members of the 23rd Headquarters Special Troops. Here in our studio, Gazo Nemeth with the Signal Company Special, which specialized in radio deception, and John Jarvie of the 603rd Camouflage Engineers, which specialized in visual deception. And John, that was your voice on the clip that we just played. Tell us about that. John?
I don't know where to start.
Well, let's talk about those personnel carriers that you helped deceive the Germans with.
Personnel carriers?
Well, I mean the trucks that were bringing the troops.
We ride through with 2 guys in the back of a truck and the curtains drawn. But we make sure everyone who saw the truck pass knew that it was loaded with troops because they could see 2 troops in the back and they assumed that there were troops in the rest of the truck that he couldn't see. We did that all during the war. And we got a lot of coverage that way with very few troops. You take 10 trucks, that's only 20 guys you're going to use that way. You can go pretty far with a smaller detachment.
And Gazo, radio deception was an important part of what happened at Brest.
Well, I was told that it was about 75% or 80% of the deception was by radio, because the Germans, obviously, all they could do is hear it. They couldn't see it, you know. And it worked to perfection as far as I know, because they never wised up to it. Documents we captured from the Germans when the war's over, they never once realized what was happening when we were replacing the real divisions with our radios and enable them to go down and attack somewhere 50, 60 miles away where the Germans thought they were still upholding a static front 60 miles away, so they were not prepared for the attacks. And since they never wised up, it worked wonderful.
And Rick Beyer, there was a tragedy there when the real tanks were mistakenly directed right to the Ghost Army location, which was set up to draw fire from the enemy.
Right. So in Operation Brest, there was they were trying to draw attention to the flanks, and there was going to be an attack in the center. But some commander at some point, it's a little foggy is exactly why, decided to send tanks out from exactly the place where the Ghost Army was attracting attention. And so the Germans had zeroed in all their 88s, their big cannons on that area, and started firing at the tanks. And I know John was there when that happened, and it was a pretty upsetting experience for the guys in the Ghost Army to see the deception misused that way and people lose their lives because of it.
John, tell us about that.
Well, there was a group of officers, some who didn't know what was really going on but thought they did. And there were several small light tanks there, just so the Germans would know there were tanks there. They could see all this. And the attack was supposed to jump off at 20 to 1. I was so close I could hear the entire conversation. And they went. These light tanks were not supposed to take part in it. And some mucky muck got in there from headquarters, not knowing the real facts, and he said, "Yes, you guys have to go. You're part of it." And they protested, and he ordered them to go. And when the attack came, there was supposed to be a lot of dive bombing at 20 to 1 for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then the tanks were to kick off. And there was no real kickoff. They had some fake tanks, but he insisted the real tanks had to go too. So I think there might have been from 2 to 4 of them. And they went maybe 100 yards, and they all had their tails shot off.
You know, that
was a dismal failure.
John, that winter of late 44, early 45, worst winter in 40 years in Europe, you guys didn't have much in the way of shelter. How did you keep from freezing?
It was hard. Sometimes it just seems that you get used to it after a while. I never thought I would because I hate the cold. But in the long run, everything seemed to work. And one way or another, even if you didn't get indoors, you found a way to keep warm, even if it was just huddling together. And it was cold. It was cold.
There's a story that...
What can I say?
There's a story that John's friend Ned Harris tells. He'd found a stove, a wood burning stove, and he installed it in the back of his truck. He had one of those canvas covered trucks, so he had a wood burning stove back there to keep everything warm back there. And but then one of the officers found out that he had it in there, and he made him take it out. So it was going to be warm for a while, but then they got cold again because they thought it would be too dangerous to have the stove in the truck. So,
well, Ned was my foxhole buddy all during the war. And I know about the stove, and I know what happened. They caught him with the stove in the truck, and he had to throw it away. He had to freeze like everybody else.
Gazo, what did you do to keep warm during that long, cold winter?
Well, like Rick said, everywhere we went, you know, the civilians had to abandon. We captured little nice pot-bellied stoves and set them up. We closed the trucks in with plywood, made doors, and even got Nero mattresses. And the Europeans seemed to have Nero mattresses, put together two or three of them, and they fit on the benches perfect. It'd be a wonderful place to rest and sleep, but we weren't allowed to. We had to sleep on the ground in a sleeping bag and hope for the best. Lay out there with a helmet over your face because of our own shrapnel being shot up all the time at this little low-flying planes that the Germans would send. We call them Bedcheck Charlie because they were very slow and was hard to aim at them. And our AK-AK guns would be shooting up shrapnel, and then it would be falling on you. And like rain, you wake up in the morning and find out pieces of shrapnel all around you, and you didn't dare take the helmet off your face and hope for the best. And like I said, we passed one general one time, and he seen the smoke coming out, and he waved the convoy over, and we had to throw all the stoves out, had to throw all the mattresses out. And the best way we kept warm, we always had to have one radio operator operating, and one would be on guard duty around it. And it's a wonder we didn't die from carbon monoxide, because we'd try to hang around the exhaust pipe, because the motors kept running to keep the power going for the radio transmissions.
And John Jarvie, in the midst of that brutal winter, here comes the Battle of the Bulge, the last great push by the Germans, and you were there.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like? It must have really affected you psychologically. What I've heard from other vets is that it seemed like the war was over, and suddenly there's this last big push by the Nazis.
Well, we were up in Hochscheid, which is right on the border, the only division between Luxembourg and Germany is a river. And that was a point of impact. Exactly where we were was the first point of impact in the lower area. And we were up there kind of just to make a show of strength. But we didn't know there was going to be an attack. And it came, started early in the morning, but somehow we didn't find out about it until around 3 in the afternoon, and we were only about five miles in from the front. And what had happened, that the 28th and 29th Division had quad fours on their jeeps, and they were down there able to hold off the entire German attack until we cleared out. But we didn't find out about it until around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And Germans had been pounding on us since 5 o'clock in the morning,
and then
we were lucky to get out of there at all. There was only a little spot in the road.
And then there was one last grand deception to fool the Germans about where the troops would cross the Rhine River for that final push to Berlin, just 1,100 of you pretending to be 30,000 soldiers.
Well, Well, I'm lucky to say I was in Scotland.
John was on leave at that point.
Gazel, were you part of that?
Yes, I was on leave.
We were practically onlookers, that's all.
It was all over.
Every big shot from Winston Churchill was there with a cigar, and Montgomery and the big phony de Gaulle was there. And
Gazo, tell us what you really think.
There goes the French audience.
And they were they were expecting the crossing miles up there because that's where we were deceiving them. And everything went over like clockwork because nothing went wrong.
Well, the Nazis claimed that the Rhine River would run red with Allied blood. And the crossing ended up being, you know, really nothing, just token resistance.
No resistance at all. They never expected it at that point, so things went very smoothly.
Rick Meyer, how many lives did the Ghost Army save?
Oh, gosh, you know, it's of course impossible to answer that. There have been estimates, there were some estimates that they saved 15,000 to 30,000 lives. You know, we can't really know exactly how many. But I had an interesting experience. I met a gentleman at a screening, and he came up to me afterwards, and he said, you know, I was a tanker under Patton, and I never heard about this unit, but I think this unit might have saved my life during the war. And to think that here's a guy – and he got married, and he had kids, and he had grandkids, and that all might not have happened except for Gazo and John and the 23rd. And that is what is so inspiring about this story to me.
We're going to take another short break. When we come back, more memories from John Jarvie and Gazo Nemeth, surviving members of the Ghost Army of World War II, and Rick Beyer, who co-wrote a book about it and produced and wrote the PBS documentary. I'm Glenn Moberg. It's a special Veterans Week edition of Route 51. Here's Spike Jones with a very popular song during the war years.
Army not the Superman, Aryan pure Superman.
Yabbiest Mr. Superman.
Super duper Superman.
Is this Nazi land so good? Would you leave it if you could?
Yeah, this Nazi land is good. We would leave it if we could.
When the Fuhrer says, he is the master race. We heil, heil. Right in the Fuhrer's face. Not to love the Fuhrer is the great disgrace. So we heil, heil. Right in the Fuhrer's face.
Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs, including Steepenbrew, Marcus Center for the Performing Arts, and The Bold Company. Play a role in the success of WPR. Become a business sponsor. Go to WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Northwind Renewable Energy, Stevens Point, with a focus on renewable energy system design and installation, including solar, wood, and deep energy retrofits to existing buildings. NorthwindRE.com.
After the war, Arthur Shillstone became an illustrator, working for dozens of magazines. He was one of many Ghost Army artists who went on to successful art careers. Jack Macy was another.
I learned a lot fooling people and deceiving people, and it stood me in very good stead for the rest of my life.
Macy designed exhibits for the U.S. government, including the 1959 Moscow exhibition that was the site of the famous kitchen debate between Khrushchev and Nixon. A surprising number of Ghost Army soldiers won fame as artists and designers. Bill Blass became a fashion superstar. Ellsworth Kelly, a celebrated minimalist painter. Arthur Singer's bird illustrations earned him world renown. Art Kane's photograph of 57 musicians on a stoop in Harlem remains a jazz icon.
And we can add to that list, John Jarvie. You went on to become a successful artist, the art director for Fairchild Publications, the owner of Women's Wear Daily. John?
Yes. You caught me.
I caught you. Well, let me ask you. You know, there was one week where you guys spent in Paris, and you and your fellow artists spent a lot of time drawing everything from street scenes to prostitutes. Tell me what that was like.
Well, there's all over Paris you can find prostitutes. And it just so happened that all over Paris you could find guys with pens and pencils who were ready to draw them. And somehow they got together, found one another, and we have some successful paintings and drawings of that. I found a place myself which was not quite on the same beat as Paris, but it had the same collection of customers and whatever you call it.
Did you ever think that those sketches...
We went in there and did a lot of drawings of the soldiers there. It was a completely different atmosphere than Paris because the boys were a lot more rugged and rough.
Did you ever think, John Jarvie, that those sketches would someday become important historical documents?
No, I still don't.
Deception.
Actually, I still don't. Yeah.
You don't? Well, no. What about the fact that so many of your fellow artists went on to fame and, in some cases, fortune, but they really did influence the art and culture of post-war America?
Well, maybe so. You know, there's a tremendous collection of different kinds of artwork that came out of the 23rd Special Troops.
And Rick Beyer,
other than others.
Rick Beyer, you and Gazo did a European tour. Tell me a little bit about that. We're down to our last couple of minutes here.
Sure. So I led a tour of 29 people to Europe, a Ghost Army tour last September, and we're doing another one next September. And Gazo and Susan came along, and it was a pretty emotional journey because he had not been back to Europe since the war. And I think, you know, when we were standing there on Utah Beach or when we were at the – we literally went to the building in Luxembourg where they were billeted for a few months, and it's now a university. And he walked up the stairs and he said, well, this is the room that I lived in Luxembourg. And it was an amazing experience to travel in the footsteps of the Ghost Army with somebody who'd been there.
Gazo, so what was that like?
Well, it was really a terrific experience to be able to go back to the very room where we operated out of for off and on for several months. It was our base. And in between missions, or if we weren't chosen for a mission, we stayed in this Luxembourg Abbey, actually. And the nuns gave it up for us. In a way, when back there, it is now Luxembourg University, and it was a thrill to be able to go right back to the exact room where we stayed, but it had been torn out and made into a huge classroom, and there was classes going on when we went there, and the university president didn't even know about the history of it. A wall that was around it when we were there was torn down, and it was just out in the open now. But it was terrific to be able to go back there.
And I want to jump in. We also visited the military cemetery outside of Luxembourg where Sergeant George Peddle, who was a friend of Gazo's and one of the Ghost Army radio deceivers, is buried. He was killed in one of their operations. So that was a sobering reminder of the sacrifices that people made and the importance of this story.
John Jarvie, this whole mission was top secret for so long. How does it feel to finally get the recognition that you and your fellow comrades in arms and pens deserve?
Well, speaking for myself, and I guess for some of the guys that I've been in touch with, it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing. We feel like we're getting a pat on the back, and we didn't feel that we really did anything. That was our attitude towards what we were doing. It really was important, but to a bunch of soldiers, that they try to laugh at everything, and we laughed at ourselves.
Rick Beyer, you got the final word.
I'm sorry to embarrass you, John, but you guys may think it was nothing, but you certainly seem like heroes to me, and I'm honored to tell the story of these great men.
And I, too, am honored to have both of you gentlemen with us. Gazo Nemeth of the 23rd Headquarters Special Troops, Signal Company Special, and John Jarvie of the 603rd Camouflage Engineers, members of the Ghost Army, and historian Rick Beyer, co-author with Elizabeth Sales of the Ghost Army of World War II, and director, producer, and writer of the PBS documentary The Ghost Army. A special thanks to Colin Hansen and the school history program A Walk in Their Shoes. You can find out more at ghostarmy.org. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Dean Kallenbach, and our on-air producers, Jane Ritger and Lori Frazier. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music and audio segments today, from the soundtrack to the movie Patton, the United Newsreel Corporation's report on D-Day, Spike Jones and his City Slickers, and Roy Clark and Glenn Campbell doing Ghost Riders in the Sky. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, remember our veterans, and until next week, we're heading out of town.